roll call. For this meeting, we'll use the Adobe Connect list of participants as a basis, but are there any participants to the meeting who are on audio only at this point?
Hello, Mathieu. This is Thomas. I'm on audio only at the moment.
Hi, Thomas. Thanks for joining. I know you're not in the best of your health at this point, so we hope we recover soon enough for the Hyderabad meeting, obviously, but even faster than that. Anyone else? Okay. Any updates to statements of interest? No. So I think we have a pretty busy agenda for today with a number of updates from the groups, as well as some interesting discussions on the road to Hyderabad. So I will now turn to Liam for the next agenda item. Liam.
Thank you very much, Mathieu. This is Liam Sanchez. Hello, everyone, and our next agenda item is just a reminder of the ICANN standards of behavior for meetings. As you may well know, this group has been characterized to be one that fully respects each of the participants, and we don't want the Hyderabad meeting to be the exception. So this is just a reminder to observe the expected standards of behavior as per ICANN's usual standards of behavior. So we have this beautiful slide that has been set up by staff to remind us of the different standards of behavior. If you don't know the standards of behavior by now, we kindly encourage you to review them. And if you have any doubts, don't hesitate to come back to us so we can help you understand the standards of behavior. I don't know if there are any questions of the standards of behavior, as long as we remain respectful of the views and we remain inclusive of everyone that wants to participate, I think we will continue to manage successful meeting as we have done previously. So, as I said, there is also a link that will be circulated previous to our Hyderabad meeting that contains these standards of behavior so that everyone is familiar with them when we get to Hyderabad. And Avery is asking who enforces the standards of behavior. Well, so far, I think that is a good question, and Avery. As per our charter, the chairs are allowed to establish contact with those participants not complying with standards of behavior, so we can find a way for them to comply. And, well, of course, take this into the usual friendly manner that we have managed to ask everyone to comply. So our next agenda item is the review of the action items from the plenary. And if we could have the action items on the screen, please. So the first one is the subgroup rapporteurs should have a status and issues update for their subgroup distributed to the CCWG by end of business Friday, 21 October. This will be the base for the work in Hyderabad. I've seen a couple of reports that have been sent to the plenary list, and we definitely encourage you to review them so we can have a fruitful discussion on them in Hyderabad. And we will be going through updates on each of the subgroups in this meeting as per our agenda item number 5, so I won't go deep into this action item. Then the second one is that the Ombudsman subgroup is awaiting confirmation from staff regarding funding for the evaluation of the Office of the Ombudsman from funds outside of Workstream 2. I believe that this confirmation has already been done, and I don't know if anyone in staff would like to expand on this confirmation, but we do have confirmation about this action item. Anyone on staff would like to comment on this? All right, so let's review the next action. I see Bernie's hand is up. Bernie?
Just a note, we got this confirmation late yesterday. We're still working out the details, so there's really not much to report, except that this funding is settled, but the mechanics about how we'll work with these groups are still being worked out. Thank you.
Thanks, Bernie. So the next action item is that the CCWG Accountability continues to await the response from the board on its request with regard to ATRT 3. And yesterday, Matthew circulated a letter from our chairman of the board in which they reply to our letter on this issue. And this correspondence states that will be subject to discuss in Hyderabad with the larger community as the board feels that they are not in a position to take a decision on this issue, but rather the community should guide the board on how this issue should be advanced. So we do have a reply from the board on this issue, and we will, I think we will discuss this further in Hyderabad. And I see Bernie's hand is up. I'm not sure if that's an old hand or a new hand, Bernie. That's an old hand. Okay. Okay, so this would conclude the review of the action items, and I would like to turn back to Michael to Matthew for our next agenda item.
Thank you very much, Leon. We're now getting into the first substantive item of our agenda related to the IRP group. So this is Workstream 2. It's actually Workstream 1 implementation. As you know, one of the outstanding items is the setting up the IRP, and we have the rapporteur for the IRP subgroup, or IoT is for implementation oversight team, for an update on the progress of this group. And you will remember that we had a very little, small number of items to resolve before we could move forward on the supplemental rules. So Becky will provide us an update. Becky.
Thanks very much, and good morning, everybody. This is Becky Burr for the record. We last spoke about these three open issues in September, and I think we developed some more sense of consensus around some of the issues, but I'm hoping we can reach closure on them today so that we can publish the entire set of supplementary rules along with the explanatory paper for public comment. So let's see what happened to the this is just background on the team and the chairs. Let's go straight into the issues. Seem to have lost. I don't know if anybody's saying anything. I'm not seeing anything on the slides. Okay. Brenda, Bernie, the slides are appearing blank to me. Anybody else seeing them, or maybe there's just
having a minor technical glitch, Becky. We're working on
okay.
it.
Okay. So we'll just, I will, while people are working on it, let's just chat through the three issues. So one is the deadline to file after an event that create that constitutes or could constitute a bylaws violation. The draft language said that a claimant would have to file a written statement of a dispute with the provider no more than 45 days after a claimant becomes aware or reasonably should have become aware of the action or inaction giving rise to the dispute. The relevant language from Annex 7 actually said, talked about becoming aware of the alleged violation and how it affects them, as opposed to the reasonably aware. So we had several choices in terms of this. And when we discussed this, my sense was that people wanted to use the becomes aware of the material effect of the action or inaction giving rise to dispute, but also wanted to have an outside time by which the dispute had to be filed. And we had talked about 6 months and 12 months and 24 months. I believe that the people that we heard from in our conversation last month, most people were comfortable with the 2-year period, but there were definitely people who suggested that it should be shorter. So I think what I'd like to do is solicit any comments at this point on the sort of outside period for filing a claim. Now, while people are thinking about this one, obviously there is a great need to have a sense of closure. And that decisions that get made are closed and not reasonably contestable. On the other hand, there are things where we would not know how ICANN staff, for example, would interpret a provision of the contract, and you could not possibly know until that was actually, that interpretation was actually on the table. So the notion was to kind of find a compromise there. As I said, we had some people arguing for 6 months. We had some people arguing for 24 months, 1 year, 12 months is sort of a compromise. Sort of the midpoint in there, I would propose that we take alternative two with a 12-month date of the action or inaction. And of course, if we're talking about an interpretation of a contract or something like that, it would be 12 months from the offending interpretation as opposed to 12 months from the date the contract was entered into. So I'm not seeing any hands on that.
Thank you. Just a quick clarification. What we're trying to do here is a first reading on these items. We've actually already discussed them, but our plan is to do basically our first reading today and try to resolve these issues in Hyderabad at the latest. So that will be our second reading. And obviously, I'd like to just remind everyone, this is not the final version of the documents. They're not going to enter into force right after that. We'll go for public comment after that. So in that sense, I think the proposal that you're making is a good one, because it's also enabling for getting inputs from the public on this approach. So yeah. I would encourage people to step in, obviously, and with maybe a priority to those who are not in the IoT, because in the IoT, these issues have been discussed already at length. And I think what's valuable is to make sure we get the feedback from the plenary, so the other participants and members in the plenary. And I think, Alan, you're perfectly qualified to start. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Regarding the delay under which you can file, there was a case recently where ICANN published a implementation plan. This happens to be on ThinkWhois, but it doesn't really matter. And the registries made a comment on the plan, objecting to one of the terms in the implementation, and in parallel with that, filed an IRP just in case, because the time deadline was so short currently. It's not clear to me, however, when the deadline should have started. It's in this case, ICANN published a plan to do something, but did not formally decide to do it because it was still out for comment. And it wasn't clear that the clock even started ticking until a decision was made that this indeed was the plan that was going to be followed. So when do you become aware of it? When you become aware of the possibility of something happening, or that it definitively did happen? So it's the starting point that I'm not sure we have full clarity on.
So I actually think that the registry filed a request for reconsideration as opposed to an IRP.
You're right. I'm sorry. Correct.
That's okay. But just to take that, if the staff implementation plan was simply a proposal that was out for public comment, that clearly would not start any clock ticking. It would be a final decision that the implementation as proposed is moving forward. The other thing that happens, of course, is that there are provisions for constructive engagement and conciliation, and those all kind of toll the required filing period. So, in fact, it will be very infrequently that 45 days would be a hard deadline because we have built-in processes for ICANN and claimants to meet together, to talk, to try to resolve misunderstandings and the like. So, but in that case, Alan, I think it probably would have been had a final decision on the implementation plan been made, that's when the time period would start.
Thanks, Becky. So I think basically we are sort of moving forward with alternative two with a period of 12 months from the final decision. And we'll carry that over to the second reading. The next item, Becky?
Yes, so cross-examination of witnesses at hearings. The current rule essentially says that all hearings shall be limited to argument only, which is so that people would be making legal cases. And a number of, but we did provide that there could be face-to-face hearings called if it meets the standards presented, the extraordinary standards. It would serve. It is necessary for a fair resolution of the dispute. It furthers the purposes of the independent review process itself and the interest of a fair resolution outweigh the costs and delay. And when there have been face-to-face hearings, typically there have been fact witnesses. A number of people believe that if there are going to be witnesses, then cross-examination should be allowed. And others were concerned about the added complexity that this brings. One approach is that we can say that the IR panel would determine if a party seeking cross-examination of a witness has demonstrated that such cross-examination is necessary for a fair resolution of the claim, necessary to further the purpose of the IRP, and considerations of fairness and furtherance of the process of the IRP outweigh the time and financial expense of witness cross-examination. An alternative, and I think many people would argue, look, if there are going to be witnesses, if there are going to be fact witnesses at a face-to-face hearing, then the other side should have an opportunity to cross-examine. And so the standard is that that's something that we have to think about is whether if one side can have a fact witness, is the other side entitled, should be permitted. So on this one, I think the weight of opinion is that the determination about whether the hearings are include fact witnesses and the limitation to argument only goes away is something that should be made at the extraordinarily level. The appearance of a fact witness is necessary for a fair resolution of the claim, necessary to further the purposes of the IRP, and considerations of fairness and furtherance outweigh the time and financial expense of witness cross-examination. And if the determination to expand the face-to-face hearing to include fact witnesses is made, then the IRP panel should determine whether, and I guess this is all other types of hearings, telephonic video hearings. So I think that actually in our conversations we have gotten this a little bit wrong. And what I would like to propose is that the question about whether hearings are limited to argument only is the question that is subject to the extraordinary standard that the party seeking to expand to include fact witnesses, has demonstrated that it meets the extraordinary standards. And then once that happens, if the claimant makes that case and the panel determines that has been made, then cross-examination of fact witnesses should be permitted. So this is a slightly different approach than we have discussed, and I will write it up and send it around to people. But I think what we are talking about is applying the extraordinary standards to the question of whether a hearing is limited to argument only, and then if it is expanded to include fact witnesses, the panel will determine in its discretion whether or not to prohibit or to permit cross-examination.
Thank you. Maybe.
So I think,
maybe test whether there's anyone who's feeling very uncomfortable with that approach moving forward. I think there's a comment from Cavus in the chat about alternative 2 and 3, which are quite close. But I think the approach you're suggesting is also, I'm interpreting silence as assent on the way forward. So let's move to I think we have one last item on this.
Yes. And the one last item, I do not see it here.
Here we go.
This is the typically when you change substantive rules, the standards that applies are the rules that were in place at the time an independent review was started. Right now, and I'll be very concrete about this, right now the standard, well, not now, not anymore, but prior to the transition, the bylaws standard for review provided a lot of deference to ICANN. And ICANN has in some independent reviews argued quite robustly that a very high degree of deference should be provided to the decisions of the ICANN board. The accountability CCWG rejected that very high level of deference and said, no, there's going to be a de novo review, and the panel is going to determine, based on a review of the facts, whether ICANN violated the bylaws or not. The question is, what happens to the independent review cases that are in process right now? And a number of people have said, look, ICANN has been on notice for a really long time that the community didn't like the standard that was put into the bylaws in 2012, I think it was. ICANN has known for a really long time that people didn't like the process by which it was adopted and didn't like the standard and that the standard was going to change. And so it would be unfair for ICANN to essentially continue now, particularly after the rules have changed for everybody going forward, to continue to insist on the deferential standard. And so in an extraordinary case where a decision turns on the standard of review, the party should be able to say it would be unfair to proceed in this way. And as Aubrey has pointed out, it seems like we allow, we do allow retroactivity to future changes in the supplemental rules. The problem is that the standard of review is actually in the bylaws. Most of the stuff in the supplemental rules are not in the bylaws, and they can be changed, and they are essentially procedural, and they can be changed in a kind of procedural way. The standard of review is in the bylaws, and it cannot be changed except through a bylaws change. My concern, I have the utmost sympathy for people who are annoyed about the deferential standard. But I do think that if we made the standard of review affirmatively retroactive and somebody could say, no, I'm going to reopen my case based on the standard of review, then what they would be doing is saying, we want ICANN to apply a standard that is different from what the bylaws say. And so somebody who may have been the beneficiary of the application of the standard of reviews in the bylaws immediately has an IRP case saying ICANN is violating its bylaws. So even though I understand absolutely why it seems unfair in the extreme that ICANN could have kept insisting on this deferential standard once it was clear that the standard was changing. I think we have a bylaws violation. So Aubrey's asking about, if we're only talking about cases in progress, why does it affect closed cases? Well, it wouldn't affect closed cases. It would affect open cases, but there are a number of open cases. And so, you know, without having gone through a fine-tooth comb here, we don't know what will happen. Caboose is making a plea in the chat to not make the rules complex and ununderstandable. I think that that is what we're talking about is a very complex legal problem, but the simple solution and the solution that in fact is standard in these cases is that the rules that are in place at the time you file a claim are the rules under which your claim is considered. And so I would propose I'm stepping out of my chair role in a moment here to say, essentially, I think that's the rule we should apply. Now, I can have a lot of, I can choose how hard it wants to argue that standard, and IRPs have rejected the deferential standard in a number of cases. What I am saying is we should, given the extremely complex and particularly contentious issues that arise, we should choose the ordinary path of applying the rules that were in place at the time a claim is filed.
Thanks, Becky. I understand that, in your view, that's the safest option and probably simplest as well. Any objection to that approach to be carried forward in the second reading and then the public comment? I am seeing none, though obviously it's a sensitive issue, so it might have some. We might have to discuss this some on the list, but it's carried forward. One last item, Becky, is the once we have the supplemental rules, we'll need to select panelists for the IRP. Any update on the progress on that side?
Yes, David McCauley, who's on the call, has put together a draft request for expression of interest for the panelists, and that will also be something that will finalize and circulate and have available for further discussion and revision in Hyderabad.
Thank you, Becky. I think that's good because these two pieces are the key parts of the architecture of the Workstream 1 recommendations, and it's really good to see that we're making progress, and I'm hopeful that by the time the regular IP meeting in Hyderabad opens, we can report some significant steps forward on that path. So that's really excellent. Thank you to you, Becky, as well as the rest of the IoT group for that work. And I think that we've been quite productive. We can now move to the reports from the subgroups, and I'm turning back to Leon.
Thank you very much, Mathieu. This is Sanchez. And as I said previously, we will be going through the reports of the subgroups on the progress that they've made through the calls that they've held in the last couple of months. And the first group that will be reporting for us is the transparency group. And for that, I would like to handle the floor to Michael Karanikolas. Michael, could you please update us on the transparency report? And by the way, I just want to say that we do have a report on this, and this would constitute the first reading on the transparency report review. So, Mike, could you please take the floor?
Hi, can you hear me? Hello?
Yes, Mike.
Okay, great. Sorry. all right. So, yeah, thanks very much for that. As you all have hopefully seen, we've developed the first draft of the transparency report. I think we had a robust process where we started by soliciting feedback and got some great ideas in from people in the group. We presented a first draft of our working group paper last week. We circulated it to the subgroup last week and then had a meeting on Friday to receive initial feedback from them. And then based on that feedback, we revised it again. So as you can see, it's divided into three major sections. The first deals with reforms to the DIDP. The second is related to proactive disclosure and information that should be published by ICANN as a matter of course. And the third is based on whistleblower protection, whistleblower policies that ICANN has. So, for the most part, I just want just to give like a brief introduction as to the issues that we tackled and the issues that we're still looking at. There are specific recommendations for each of these sections, but through the research and also through the meeting on Friday, it was also revealed to us that there are areas that we need to consider quite a bit more. So I also included as part of the paper a few discussion questions or questions for further thought that we intend to address as part of this process. And so if you're going to give feedback, we welcome feedback on anything, obviously, but in particular, any guidance on the specific questions that we asked would be particularly helpful. So with regards to the DIDP, that involves first considering how the IRP process works with the DIDP, which I guess is going to tie into a previous conversation. We're not looking to have parallel processes, but it is worth thinking about in that context. And second is how the DIDP should apply to non-disclosure agreements that ICANN has signed, where there were different opinions that have been raised on that at the meetings. In terms of proactive disclosure, right now we're only dealing with lobbying transparency. That needs to be extended to discuss more information about financial transparency and more information about how board deliberations, information about them should be made available. So those are areas that we're still exploring. And with regard to whistleblower protection, we're looking at the main question that we need to ask is whether we should allow the whistleblower hotline to be available to business partners and who should be able to access it, basically, how widely it should be, that process should be available. Beyond that, I think the best thing to do is to just sort of let the document speak for itself, and we'd be very happy to hear any feedback that people have as to our approach and the recommendations that we've provided. And I see Caboose's hand is up.
Thank you very much. And yes, Caboose is first on the queue. So, Caboose, could you please take the floor? If you are speaking, we can't hear you. You might be on mute. Carlos, we cannot hear you. Hello, do you hear me? Yes, we hear you now, Carlos. Thank you. Okay, sorry. Sincere congratulations to Michael, Chris, and Barbara for very good piece of work that they have provided, and they are front runner within this 9 group that has been established for WorkStream 2. Congratulations. Well done. I suggest that if other colleagues agree, we just take this document as the first consideration and not taking as a first reading, because there might be some question. At least I did not have time to go through the document in detail. I may not have any comment at all, but I suggest that we just
take it as a consideration and go to the first and second reading at a later stage if everybody agrees to that suggestion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kavus. Are there any other comments? I see that Farzani is asking whether the group is at recommendation stage. I see no other hands. Oh, yes, Sebastian Bachelet's hand is up. Sebastian, could you please take the floor?
Thank you. Thank you, Leon. To say, it's Sebastian Bachelet speaking. I didn't have, obviously, the time to read it as I was preparing for this meeting and for the Ombuds subgroup, but I know that in my report, I guess I will give you later, there are some points that we have to discuss with both groups. Then I think it will be useful to have those how we want to organize cross subgroup work on certain items, and here there is one between the transparency and the Ombuds working group. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Sebastian. Let's not forget that the readings are a way to have the document ready for public comments and not in a final stage. So I would encourage us to have these as the first reading of this report that has been put by the subgroup. And this doesn't prevent us, of course, from reviewing it in a deeper way. And it also allows us to post our questions and comments through the list and also in our face-to-face meeting in Hyderabad. So I would encourage us to keep these as the first reading from this report and try to, of course, flesh out the different details that need to be put in place in order for this document to be ready for public comment before our Hyderabad meeting and, of course, continued discussion in Hyderabad with the adjustments that should be made as per the questions raised and the comments made by the larger group. So are there any other questions or any other comments on the transparency report at this stage? I see Steve Del Bianco's hand is up. Steve?
Thank you, Leon. Steve Del Bianco with the CSG. I'm aware that over the last 2 years, we've had several individuals who used the DIDP and were very dissatisfied with the way in which ICANN responded. And I wanted to ask whether this transparency team included individuals with experience at DIDP and whether their experiences are reflected in the recommendations so that we can avoid those problems in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Mike, would you like to comment on Steve's remark?
Sure. I mean, I can't say specifically how many people within the subgroup have used the DIDP because I obviously don't have that information for everybody who's participating. But what I can say is that there has been work published by people and comments made by people on the list who've expressed frustrations with the DIDP and how it works, and certainly we've taken that into account. Actually, no, that's not true. I have gotten, as I think back to the specific comments that we've gotten, we heard about people who were complaining about overuse of particular exceptions, which we factored in. We heard about people that were complaining about delays and how it was taking too long to get responses, which we certainly factored in. So that experience did play a role, although the main focus of our of the analysis, I think, was on improving the policy itself. And so so we were mostly focused on how the policy should be improved, but the specific experiences certainly were important context to informing that.
Mike, as a follow-up, was Ed Morris particularly active in the DIDP section?
We got detailed feedback. Yes, we got detailed feedback from Ed on this draft.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Steve. Are there any other questions or comments in regard to transparency report? Okay. So as I said, and I know Kavu's comments on the chat, this will need to be reviewed carefully before we get to our meeting in Hyderabad so that we can, of course, address the different issues that have been raised and hopefully be ready to do a second reading on this report in Hyderabad. If it's not possible, well, of course, the discussion should continue until we are ready to have a final version for this report so that we can go to public comment. So with this, I would like to turn back to Michael to Matthew for the report on SO1AC accountability. Matthew?
Thank you very much. Just as an addition to what you said, I think on the transparency as well as in the other documents, I encourage everyone to share their questions, even on the list. Any discussion we can start on the list and take over in during our meeting is bound to be more productive. So I think I've read some concerns or issues from a number of participants in the chat. I think if we can start this discussion on the list, we'll be even more efficient. Now, turning to the second update, which is the SOAC accountability group, I think Farzaneh is going to provide this update. Farzaneh, are you here with us?
Yes, I am.
Yes, I did hear you.
Matthew, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So if this document upload our question so that I can tell the group about. Okay. So our group, according to the CCW Workstream 1 report, is charged with coming up with a work plan to enhance an SOMAC accountable. This is one of the tasks that the report has assigned. In order to carry out the task, the group decided to first ask SOMAC what sorts of accountability mechanisms they have in place. We discussed with the group how to formulate the question. And, oh, I'm sorry, you can hear me? Oh, okay. I thought I had good audio, but it seems like
It's indeed a little muffled, but the volume was good for me at least. For some, it's faint.
Okay. Shall I shout, or is that not going to help?
That is quite good here.
Okay. Okay. So I just sit closer to the mic. So then we discussed with the group how to formulate the questions to be forwarded to SOMAC's chairs. And based on the group discussion and comments, we came up with the following question. So the first question is about designated community. The designated community is actually defined by the bylaws, but the group asked, okay, great. So the group asked the, sorry, I cannot somehow miss this, okay. Okay, so the group asked, the group has laid out how the designated community is defined by the bylaws, but also asked the SOMAC what the interpretation what sort of interpretation they have of the designated community, if their interpretation is more broad or narrower than the bylaws commission. So we are not defining the designated community of each SONAC. If they have a different interpretation, they can relay that in their response. Then the questions are, another set of questions are about accountability-related policies and procedures. So we asked, what are the published policies and procedures, by which the SONAC is accountable to the designated community? For example, the policies and efforts in outreach to individual and organizations in the designated community who do not participate in SONAC. And also the policy and procedures to determine whether individual or organizations are eligible to participate in SONAC meetings, discussions, working groups, etc. And also a question on whether they have transparency mechanisms for their SONACs on deliberations, decisions, and elections, and whether these policies and procedures being updated over the past decade, if they can clarify what sort of needs they have, community needs they have addressed with that office. And another aspect of the question is mechanisms for challenging or appealing elections. And the other question is about whether they have unwritten policies that are relevant to this exercise, and if they can describe those. So these are the set of questions that our group has come up with in order to send to SONAC chairs. And we wanted to receive questions with in the plenary to receive comments and feedback. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you very much, Fanzane. I see Steve's hand is up, so first in line for a question or comment.
Thanks, Matthew. It's Steve Del Bianco. I'm one of the co-chairs, along with Farzi and Cheryl Langdonor, the rapporteurs in this group. And I wanted to add two elements of clarification. The first is that we are able to find many documents online to answer what the charter asks us to do. But we thought that for the avoidance of doubt, we wanted to put these questions to the SONAC leaders so that they could inform us of documents that we might not even find online, or describe practices that an SONAC uses which aren't written down anywhere. All that would be helpful information, and we didn't want to take for granted that if we couldn't find it on the SOAC's website or wiki, that there were no such policies anywhere. The second clarification is that we fully understand that most ACs and SOs are supported by ICANN staff, the group that works for David Olive. And to that extent, we'd welcome if SONAC leaders referred some or all of these questions to the particular ICANN staffer that supports them, so that that staffer can gather the references, documents, and links that we are asking for. And, of course, the SONAC can add any color or interpretations that they see fit. We did note on the first page of these questions that we repeated from the ICANN bylaws the old bylaws, not necessarily anything that's changed recently. We repeated the target or designated community for each of the SOs and ACs. And remember that each of us as SOs and ACs, we are creatures of the ICANN bylaws for the most part. That's why we exist, because the ICANN bylaws created us. And so there is where we turned to understand who we are supposed to represent. And we are inviting your clarification or interpretation on whether that bylaws description fits what you think of as your served community, your designated community. So I hope that helps to clarify. Thanks again, Farzi.
Thank you very much, Steve. I see Kavus' hand is up, and then I have a question of mine as well. But Kavus first. Jessica was. Carlos, you have significant background noise. If it's your sound that we're hearing, but we can't hear your question, or if you're speaking, we cannot hear you. Maybe while Cavus is trying to fix, we're trying to fix the audio issue with Cavus. A question of scope, actually, when that came to my mind when I heard you speaking, Fadi, was are we planning to ask, in the case of the GNSO, are we planning to ask only the GNSO or also the stakeholder groups and the constituencies? What's the scope of our inquiry here with these questions? Fadi?
Yes, and Matthew, actually we discussed that with the group, and the last discussion that we had, the group did not agree that we specify that the question should be forwarded to the constituency and stakeholder groups, and I think it's up to the SOMEs to decide whether they want to send the questions to the various stakeholder groups and constituencies that they have. I believe that is the conclusion.
Thank you, Fadi. That's very clear, and that's a very useful clarification, I think. Cavus, I hope your audio is back.
I think it is established. I have one general comment that I shared with somebody privately, and that is the following. Any question to the SONAC which provoke or invoke any investigation by one SO in relation to the activities and the conducting of the work of other SO and AC will give rise to some sort of unhealthy environment, retaliations, competitions, and problems. E.g., GAC should not put in question how discussion is being held in GNSO, how decision is made in GNSO, and so on and so forth. So we should not put the SO and AC in front of each other. This is a comment that I make, and I would like to have assurance that that is not the case, because I saw in one draft made by somebody, this is the case. Now, having said that, I heard that the question is raised to the chief or head of SOAC. No, the question is addressed to SOAC, to the head of the SOAC, because chief or head of SOAC is not or are not authorized that on behalf of the SOAC, without being discussed there, to bring something back to the group. So we should avoid that. And thirdly, I heard from Steve Del Bianco that there are information available to the secretariat. And then he says that the same thing is asked from SOIC. We should not have two parallel paths. Either you get the information from the ICANN staff, put them together, and revise your question, but send it to SOAC, but not in parallel. You should not put or create two parallel course of action, because that may give rise to some contradiction of information. Either you trust the SOAC and ask them the question, or you trust the ICANN staff and don't ask SOAC, but you do not ask both of them at the same time. Maybe one after the other. You ask the staff, ICANN, to provide information, gather them, and send it to SOAC, but not at the same time. So that is the difficulty that I have. And fourthly, question was very, very nice, but answer are very, very difficult. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cavus. Just my understanding from what Steve said about ICANN staff was not that the questions would be sent to staff, but that, for instance, the GAC secretariat or the GAC staff support might be able to prepare a response on behalf of the GAC, so that it doesn't create any additional burden on the volunteers and the different members. So I think your concern is taken into account, Cavus, on that one. And I think your point on the accountability sort of between the different ASOs and ACs seems to be taken into account. Certainly we'll have to double check that, but I'm confident about this. Cherry, you're next.
This is a question to Stephen Farzana. When Cavus asked this question, it just triggered a thought in my mind, and this is just for clarification. The board, when we worked on the accountability of the board, it was clear that the board is accountable to the community and its stakeholders. So that's clear. Now we talk about SOs and AC accountability. I would appreciate some response to that question. Who are they, the SOs and ACs, accountable to? And what are the checks and balances? So I'm not clear on that, and really I would appreciate some where the thinking is going from Steve or Farzana. Thank you.
Thank you, Chirin. Farzana, Steve, Chiro, who wants to answer?
I can take a crack at it, Matthew. It's Steve Del Bianco. Shireen, the charter for this SOAC accountability subgroup in Workstream 2 is precisely to dive into those questions and answer them. The work our group has done so far says that when you want to know the accountability of an SO and AC, you start with the community that the SO and AC was created to represent. And therein on page one is the list of how the bylaws describe ALAC's designated community, GNSO's designated community. So the first level of accountability is to the community that an AC and SO was designed to serve. Within that, there's a discussion of members of that designated community who choose not to participate in that AC or SO, or perhaps they're unaware by lack of exposure. Perhaps they chose to participate and found it difficult to penetrate the acronym soup, or they were not eligible to participate. So the targeted community, the designated community, is one universe, and within that universe, we are trying to discover the degree to which it is open to participation from any of them, any member of that community. A second and broader level is whether the global Internet stakeholder group, which implies all Internet stakeholders, whether there is any accountability to that broader group on the part of an AC and SO. We don't believe that the bylaws are at all clear about that. We don't believe that the charter for Workstream 2 SO and AC accountability explicitly calls for that. But there is a paragraph on mutual accountability roundtable. It came from one of our outside independent experts, and it made its way into the charter for this group and the bylaws and otherwise. So we are going to be attentive to that, although our group does not have a clear opinion about whether and how we need to change the way that an SO and AC exposes its deliberations and policies to the broader world and how well it considers public comments that come from those outside of the designated community. Shireen, I hope that's helpful.
Thanks, Steve. And yes, Shireen, this is precisely where the group needs to focus its work, and I think that's part of the questions they're raising. Is that okay, Shireen?
Thank you, yes. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Shireen. Next is Alan, and I will close the queue after Cavus because we'll need to move on. This discussion will obviously be carried through to Hyderabad and on the list. Alan.
Yep, thank you very much. I just wanted to make clear, I have no problem starting with the bylaw definitions, as it were. They are not particularly, they were not written, I do not think, for this kind of exercise. And for instance, I'll pick another AC and SO, which we're not supposed to be doing, but I will. The GNSO is open to certain categories of people, which makes it very clear that it is only composed of those who choose to participate. And in my mind, there is some, they probably have some obligation to represent or think about those who have not chosen to be members or don't even know about the GNSO. The ALAC is written in a different wording that one can read it as only the individual users that choose to participate, it is their home, or we actually have to think about all 4 billion users. So the wording there is somewhat vague, and I think the challenge right now, and that is the process the group is following, is to ask the ACs, what do you think your constituents are, or who they are, and how is it you relate to them? And there's going to be a lot of variation. Each of the groups is very, very different from each other. And it ranges from the ASO, where the constituent members are formally represented, and there is no question about the others. There are no others. And it is to the other extent in the ALAC, where we're talking about 4 billion people, and we don't regularly send them all emails. So the answers are going to be very different from each of the groups, and I think our challenge right now is to at least get some answers and then see if we can make some sense out of them and find some common ground. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan, for accurately describing the different steps that are taken by the group right now. Carlos, that will be a last question. Since it's your second intervention on the topic, can I ask for conciseness in the spirit of leaving time for the other groups?
I don't know whether it's 7 or 2 or 3. I don't know. But if you count it, no problem. I have difficulty with mutual accountability for the reasons provided before. And I have difficulty to ask the SO and AC, what is your interpretation of designated community? This is a very, very legal and complex question. It's a waste of time in SO and AC. This has already been settled in the first stream or worker stream one. We should not ask this question, what is your interpretation of designated community? I do not agree with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. So in the interest of time, I think we can note in the conclusion that you stated this view about not asking this question and try to work this out on our way to Hyderabad, where we'll try to finalize this set of questions. I think we're not that far on this. I feel there might be some a little bit of misunderstanding on the intent here. And I'm sure we can work this out easier in a face-to-face meeting. So with that, I'm now turning to Leon for the next subgroup update.
Thank you very much, Matthew. This is Leon Sanchez again. And I'm not sure if we have Lori Shulman back with us. I believe that she had some problems with the Adobe Room, and I don't see her actually on the Adobe Room. So I would like to then have an update from the human rights group, and for that I would kindly ask any of the rapporteurs from the subgroup to please provide an update. I believe that Niels could be in a position to provide an update on this, but I don't see him online as well, so I'm not sure if we have someone from the human rights subgroup that's able to provide us with an update on the work that you've been doing. If that is not the case, then I think we could go to
Leon?
Yes?
Ijani speaking.
Yes, Jan.
As for the human rights subgroup, Niels has sent you a status report about our work. So I think you may read it. It gives the state of our work. But we, to give you the last word about that, we are not yet ready to give you any recommendation or any final work or any proposal for our work. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tigani. And just as a clarification, I didn't mean to skip any of the items that are in the agenda. I was just trying to substitute the items that I was supposed to chair with the next available item in hand. So there are, of course, no intentions of skipping any of the updates from the different subgroups. Tigani, thank you very much for this intervention on behalf of the Human Rights Subteam. And for that, I would now turn back to Mathieu so we can go to the next agenda item, which is staff accountability.
Thank you, Leon. So the next agenda item is actually the previous one. If you're following correctly, I'm sure you are following this quite closely. So we are now moving to the staff accountability subgroup update, and I assume that Avery is going to provide us this update. Avery?
Hello. Certainly. Thank you. This is Avery speaking. We did submit a report. Can I be heard?
Yes, perfectly.
Nobody is telling me I can be heard. Okay. I did submit a PDF, so wouldn't mind it being shown as all the previous ones were. We didn't quite make the 21st deadline, but we did make the 23rd over the weekend, so hopefully that's no reason for excluding that update. Early ages, in the early stages, but we have been trying to gather information. We started our effort to gather information even before our issues report, since our issues report was one of the ones that came later. But unfortunately, the questions we had submitted for the issues report didn't make it into there, so they're still pending. We have subgroup dependencies with ombudsman, transparency, and diversity that have turned up in our discussions. We've had few meetings, but we are working mostly within a document on Drive. It was a very successful way of working in the CWG on some of the subgroups, so we're trying to keep our meetings at a minimum while working online. What we do have is a fair number of staff dependencies. One thing, we have tried to schedule a meeting with Joran, first for the whole group. When that wasn't successful, we decided to schedule a private one between the two co-rapporteurs with him. We think that's going to happen, but then there were accusations that we weren't being transparent about it. So hopefully it will still happen. And we really wanted to ask him several questions. One, based on his role in setting the culture of staff, we wanted to understand what his policy and approach would be. We also had a discussion where we thought it was very important that staff members be able to participate in a group on staff accountability as members, but safely without any fear of repercussion if they said anything that wasn't approved by their direct managers or beyond. We asked a bunch of questions because it really is like working with a black box in some sense on various documentation that defined staff's role vis-a-vis the community, that what powers have been delegated by the board to the CEO in terms of broad independence of action. We're looking for elements, and that's where I'm in the moving down here. I didn't talk about description of issue at all, but the questions show up. So I've talked about state of plan dependencies, and we're really we're in the section on questions. What elements of following documents or similar document systems are in place regarding code of conduct, transparency obligations criteria, induction training, key performance indicators, cross-function communication and influence? Are there any, you know, conflict of interest firewalls between different ICANN functional units? We're asking how is staff accountability to the community broadly expressed, audited, monitored, reviewed? We're asking whether ICANN seeks feedback from the community on matters related for staff accountability, and how does it solicit and consider the feedback? processes in place to respond to community concerns regarding staff accountability, including appropriate escalation process, which runs into the ombudsman. What role does ICANN see the ombudsman function as playing, helping to assure appropriate staff accountability? And then a question has come up recently, are individual staff members accounted to the ICANN community, or are they only accountable to the ICANN business organization, the staff hierarchy? In other words, are there multiple points of staff accountability for the community, or is only the CEO accountable? And those are questions we've been researching them on our own, have not found answers online easily. Perhaps they're there, but we haven't found them. So as I said, we asked some of these informally before the issues report was written. Now, we've had the questions online for a while, but we haven't made a formal request. I guess we're trying to figure out our next step in making a formal request. Who do we make it of, since having the list there for staff to see what was inadequate to precipitate answers? So how do we make this formal, and are we in a position where we'll have to use the DIDP in order to get this kind of information? We really don't know what our next steps in there. We also have a pending question where we want to know what actions are being taken with regard to reports of staff accountability activities that were brought up in the DOT Registry LLC versus ICANN IRP decision. So we've been looking for some signs of that action to understand how that has been treated, since it was an accountability issue, to help us understand better the work we're doing. So we're still on the Copenhagen track, and we hope we get there, but we do have a lot of questions so that we understand the basics of where we're working. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Avery. It's a very thorough work you're describing, and nothing that surprises any of us, considering the amount of skills and experience in the group. We are planning to have an exchange with the ICANN CEO, Joran, in the face-to-face meeting. I assume some of these questions would be good to address with him as part of this exchange. Am I correct?
If you're asking me, I'm hoping that he does participate. I'm also hoping that he does have the conversation that Jordan and I have asked to have with him, but we have not gotten confirmation of that yet.
Yes, indeed, considering the details in the question, certainly an intervention in the plenary from your end is not going to be sufficient to address everything, but it certainly would be a start. Any comments on the update from Avery and the Staff Accountability Group? We have a discussion in the chat regarding accountability. The reminder that obviously staff is accountable to the hierarchy. I think this is well noted and part of the subgroup discussion already. Any other question? If not, considering we have 40 minutes left, Sebastian.
Sorry, Mathieu, just very short, if you can hear me, Sebastian Bachelet speaking. One of the items we need to discuss is the question of the newly created complaints office within the legal department of ICANN, and I think it's in link with staff accountability and with other, like the ombuds subgroup, and it's a question we need to raise with Joran in Hyderabad. Thank you.
Thank you, Sebastian. That's indeed noted and perfectly appropriate. So we are going to... yes, someone wants to speak? No, that was probably just a background. So we're moving to the next item, which is a previous one. I think we have Rory back online.
Yes.
So back to you, Leon, for the next update.
Hi, can you all hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes, Rory.
Oh, good. Okay, I'm only on the mobile phone. I do not have access to the room at the moment. So please bear with me. I'm reading from my notes, not out of the chat, so I can't see what people are saying. But I'm assuming right now in the room there is on the for viewing is the annotated first draft of guidelines. Our group has made progress with the guidelines, and we are now discussing this very, very preliminary draft. I would call it not even a first read, but a pre-first read. We're hoping to have something more finalized by the report by the end of the week, so we can submit it for Hyderabad. But I did think it would be a good idea for the group to at least see the direction in which we're heading and to get meaningful feedback as early as possible so that we could include it in any draft moving forward. As I reported, I think it was 2 weeks ago, I submitted a written report to the list, and I had expressed that our group decided that we would keep the guidelines as simple as possible in as much non-legalistic language as possible, and to really leave the specific procedures and specific guidelines at the doors of the SOAC, particularly when it comes to the removal of SOAC board nominees. So based on the discussions that we had in the group, we came up with the draft that you see. There's a part one for all board seats and a part two that applies for SOAC nominees, since there are two tracks for board removal. So for all board seats, I will read it aloud if people will indulge me. It could be for any cause. We are not going to name specific causes. That was part of the report in work stream one. That petitions for removal should be fact-based in sufficient detail to verify facts, supply supporting evidence if available, include references to applicable bylaws and or procedures if the assertion is that a specific bylaw or procedure has been breached, and be respectful and professional in tone, as this is a very serious matter. Part two is the track for SOAC nominees specifically. I will tell you that bullets A, B, and C are where we would really like feedback, whether this group thinks that the first three bullets are even necessary. There's been some questioning among our smaller group that perhaps by having these first three bullets, we're actually setting up cause and maybe contrary to the report. So I think it is important to discuss bullet D, everybody seems to be in agreement with. But, one, we would expect that the SOACs would establish expectations for board member effectiveness with regard to representing SOAC interests, transmit the expectations to the board members within a specified period of time upon taking a seat on the board, clarify that the SOAC expectations are in addition to any cause that may be brought forth without limiting the cause. And this would be the provision that allows, again, and would comport with the report that says we don't want an exhaustive list of causes. And D, develop procedures for consideration of SOAC director removal petition notices that include, one, a reasonable time frame for investigation, two, written verification of claims, and three, consistent voting methods for accepting or rejecting a petition. So these are our basic guidelines. We do have some questions. You'll see them in the footnotes there. Whether or not we want to elaborate as to what we recommend as a fair time frame, or do we leave that to the SOACs? We refer to a reasonableness standard, but it would be very helpful from the community, perhaps, to create some document, a side document that would talk about what those expectations might be, given that this is a first impression issue for ICANN. And we are also debating whether or not the group should produce a recommended standard form that all communities use to raise the issue of board removal to the respective body, whether it's to the SOAC or to the decisional participant in case of a non-com appointee. So that's where we are. I do want to add two notes to this draft. One is we did send a question to the legal group and letting them know that we do believe we will need some type of legal advice and legal time. First being that we believe, or it's the opinion that I've expressed in the group, that the whole issue of diligence, whether or not an individual or a group is acting in good faith, really rests on process. And that as long as we have a clear and documented process, we should be able to meet a good faith standard. However, given the quirks of California law, we certainly would want our guidelines reviewed by a very experienced independent attorney to make sure there aren't any red flags, that we're not missing any provision of California law that would make these guidelines irrelevant or not usable. However, following that question, we did also express a concern about a possible conflict of interest with an in-house team that reports essentially to the board. And so the question we put to the legal team is whether or not this particular conflict has been vetted in terms of creating guidelines for good faith conduct for petitioning a board member's removal, or the entire board for that matter, and whether or not having a legal team that reports to the board is sufficient to review it. I'm also adding that our board liaison, Lito Ibarra, and our second board liaison, Rinalia Ben-Abrahim, have both have volunteered that the board will also be putting some input into this document, which I think would be very helpful at this stage because we are working as a community, and I think to leave the board input out would be leaving out an important party to the process. And as I can't see the chat, I'm going to stop and breathe, and if anybody has any questions, I'm welcome to ask. You know, you're welcome to ask, and I'll answer to the best of my ability.
Thank you very much for this update, Lori. I'm sorry, this is Leon Sanchez again. And I see that there's a question by Robin on the legal team and the role that we should be playing on that. Yes, the legal team is alive, and the legal team should, of course, be meeting soon so that we can begin to address the different issues that are posed upon us, and we can, of course, provide a quick reply to those issues. So yes, this is the first request that has been posed to the legal committee. So I think this is a good start for us to get back on track with the work of the legal committee. So yes, the legal team is alive, Robin. And I see that Alan Gruber's hand is up. So Alan, could you please take the floor?
Thank you very much. I just wanted to highlight one of the difficulties that we have, and I'm part of this team. You will recall in the CCWG, we had long discussions on whether board members needed to be removed for cause, which tends to be a legal term, or we could simply do it because we in ACSO or the group of ACSOs as applicable could do it simply because, you know, there had been a parting of the ways, so to speak. And we ended up siding on the latter. And, you know, to use the ridiculous example, if we wanted to remove a director because they wear purple pants, then that is our rationale. It's not cause, it's a rationale. Terms like they have to be fact, their removal has to be fact-based, brings into question, is the fact that I don't like purple pants and you're wearing them sufficient? Is that really a fact, or does it have to be some misdemeanor that you have done, some specific act have done, which can be said in violation of what we believed? So we have this conflict of trying to put words in to make sure that people are acting in good faith and have a process they can follow, at the same time not be limited because of the way the CCWG decided that there doesn't need to be a cause, but there does need to be a rationale. And that's the tightrope we're walking, and just wanted to highlight that. And where the words come is going to be interesting.
Yeah, hi. I know. I think to your point, that is a key issue we're facing, and this document may, in fact, not adequately address it. But we needed to start somewhere. But I'm wondering if then maybe we say instead of maybe for any cause, do we make it so loose as to say for any reason? You know, reason is different than cause. It doesn't have the same legal legal ramifications, but then when you go to reason, you go back to reasonableness, and it's the reasonableness, and I think we could agree on that, that to just remove a board member arbitrarily doesn't make sense, that there should be some sort of bumpers that we put into place so that board removal is not arbitrary.
Yeah,
because I don't think the community said, well, arbitrarily anybody can be moved just because. And I don't read it that way, but if others do, I'd be interested in knowing.
Yeah, I believe, but I'm certainly will bow to those who actually have the words in front of them, that the wording we use is there has to be a rationale, but not a cause, and I'm not sure where reason fits in between the two.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, that's where, again, I think posting this very initial thought to the list early to get this kind of feedback so we can get correct wording that comports with the spirit and the letter of the report is vital.
Yeah.
Because we are trying to keep it simple, so we do have to be careful. We don't want to waste the words either.
Yeah, I wasn't saying I disagree with what's here. I'm just pointing out to the whole group the difficulty, the tightrope we're walking. Thank you.
Oh, yes, thank you. I appreciate that. And I kind of use that as an opportunity to let people understand what we are talking about internally as well, that we're the wordsmithing. You know, if there are other words that the community, and particularly this group, if there's other words that you can see as substitute wording, that's what we're asking for, that might bring some clarity to this. This document is up on Google Docs. I will be sending a link out after this call. We could post we're posting the link to our internal group list, but I don't see any reason not to post it more broadly if people have an interest.
Okay, thank you very much for this answer, Laurie, and for the question, Ellen. Are there any other questions or comments on this issue? Okay, I see no other questions, but I do want to point out a reference that was made on the chat by Cavus, DSO, and ACA subgroup co-chairs and rapporteurs in regard to the belief that they are pushing the group and not conducting meetings. I would kindly encourage those who are not in agreement with how things are being conducted in any of the subgroups to, of course, approach the coaches and approach the rapporteurs, but to also avoid this kind of confrontational team-pointing in our meetings. As Matthew has pointed, I believe that our rapporteurs in the different subgroups provide us with the best of their efforts, and they deserve our utmost respect, as Matthew has pointed. And I do want to acknowledge the great work that all of the rapporteurs have done in each of the subgroups, and of course encourage everyone to keep this conversation in a respectful way. So, Cavus, we note your disagreement, but we do believe that all rapporteurs are doing a great job in a neutral way. And the fact that someone or a group of persons are not in agreement with the rapporteurs doesn't mean that they are actually not doing their work or delivering as they are expected. So with this, I would like to turn back to Matthew for our next agenda item. Matthew?
Thank you very much, Leon. So if I'm not completely lost, our next item is Ombudsman. So Sébastien is going to have the floor. Just a timing perspective, we have less than 25 minutes left. So I think we need to consider the fact that we'll have more time to discuss in Hyderabad, and if we can have the last two updates pretty brief, that's certainly going to be helpful for us to start discussing the agenda for the Hyderabad meeting, which is still our next item. And sorry about that, Sébastien and Greg. Sébastien.
Thank you. I will say, thank you, Sébastien Bachelet speaking, and I will say, as usual, the last one get less time, but I was hoping for 3 hours for presentation, then I would just get 5 minutes. But I would like to make a point about the organization. I do feel that we don't need to discuss here the presentation. It could have been the best way. It's just I make my presentation, and if you have any question, keep them for a face-to-face. It will be more productive than to have presentation within Hyderabad, our meeting in Hyderabad. And I will go very quickly, and sorry for that. And contrary to all the other, I have a PowerPoint or a presentation and not a Word document, and I hope that you okay with that. I feel more comfortable with this type of presentation than to write something. Maybe it's my problem with skill, not just English, but writing in general. Okay, I will go quickly on what was the result of Workstream 1, because all participating to this meeting know about, but it's just to show you that we have take that into account. It's already done, this one. Those one, it's quite long list, but it's what we are doing, and I will come back into detail on our work plan that explains that what, and I will come back again on that later on. We have some issue about command with staff accountability, and that points I will raise about coordination between subgroups, and we heard about that already. Then obviously we try to liaise with the other subgroup. First items, we're working about the stress test number 34, and we are still working on that, and need to take into account the new accountability model, and particularly the employer community. I will also go very quickly on this one, because we already got a full presentation about what's happening with some of the ATRT2 recommendations, and part is now in our basket, and I think I will also come back on that later on, but now the question about the funding seems to be resolved, and we need to see how we will work on that issue. And we have an open question and waiting for inputs from the team who were ATRT2 implementation team, sorry, about some of the other points of the 9.3 recommendation from the ATRT2. And we already discussed that ICANN Ombuds Office will handle complaints about PTI. We will work on how to implement that in the document about the Ombuds Office. Then you already heard about DIP, Documentary Information Disclosure Policy, and from this transparency subgroup, we get two points who are related with our work. The one is the role of the ombuds regarding some documents if they are not released to the requester, and the second, it's what will be how the ombudsman can be included in the way to make known by participants this possibility of using the DIDP, and also if the ombuds office could be in charge of some basic statistic or not. It's something we will discuss later on, and one of our thought is to have a common meeting with transparency subgroup to discuss that specific issue and to decide what to do with. We have at least 4 items where we will need some inputs. The one with human rights, could the ICANN Ombuds Office be asked to deal with human rights complaints? The question of diversity, I know that there is a discussion about having an office on diversity. Is it where it is based, and is it including in the future ICANN Ombuds Office or not? It's something we will need to discuss with the diversity subgroup. Question of the election, and the last point is about the complaints officer, and I already talked about that earlier in one intervention. Of course, we still have in mind that we have to review the independence of the ICANN Ombuds Office, and the question of the current charter of the ICANN Ombuds Office versus the industry best practices. We need, now that we know that the budget is here, the subgroup needs to develop the requirement and the deliverable list for the one who will make the review, sorry, and how we will oversight the vendor, what will be the vendor selection process. I am sure that there are already well-established practices within the ICANN staff to do that, then we will follow them. And when we get the report, we will have to work on and to transmit it to the full CCWG. And we, of course, will have to take into account new bylaws, the employer community, and the role within the ICANN Ombuds Office. I will go to the last slide. And now that we have the confirmation of the budget, we need to prepare the evaluation requirement document. And, of course, we will have to discuss the schedule. And either it will be, in anyhow, we need to reorganize the schedule to include that. And we will have to discuss after we have the vendor, if we stop the work of this subgroup, or if we have some parallel work we can do. I think that at least the newly created function for the ombuds can be done in parallel, but it's an open question, and I will be happy to have this feedback either now on or in Hyderabad. That's my report on the ICANN Ombuds Office drafting team. For now and for the Hyderabad meeting also. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sébastien. Great that you're ready for the Hyderabad meeting. A couple of other information that you said is recent news that the HERT2 external assessment will be sort of part of the group's work. And we'll also have an update on HERT2 in our agenda provided by Larissa from ICANN staff in our agenda in Hyderabad. So that's all related points. Moving on to the last update, if there's anything new to report, handing it over to you, Leon.
Thank you very much, Matthew. And the next subgroup to report is the jurisdiction group. And I just want to note that we are 13 minutes before ending this call, so I would kindly ask for brevity and a very concise report on this. Greg, could you please update us on the jurisdiction subgroup?
Sure. This is Greg Shatton. Can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you.
Yes, Greg.
Okay, thank you. In the jurisdiction group, we've been meeting weekly and having considered and then set aside a couple of early issues. We moved on to a couple of the key topics for the group on which there is broad agreement, at least that it is properly before the group. First is going through the multiple layers of jurisdiction, which were initially set forth in Annex 12. trying to expand our understanding of those, make sure that we have a common understanding of them first in the subgroup and then that we can communicate out. So for each of these layers of jurisdiction, you'll see in the document in front of you, we have tried to explain what factually that jurisdiction layer refers to. And then the last subsection under each is at least a preliminary exploration of the effect of that layer of jurisdiction on ICANN generally. Then we'll be moving on to a more detailed discussion I'll mention in a minute. But so far you identify the jurisdiction of incorporation, jurisdiction of headquarters location, jurisdiction of other places of physical presence. It's also been suggested that jurisdictions where ICANN has important assets may be a related or separate layer of jurisdiction, and one for which separate effects may be on the list as well. I see a question in the chat. When was this report circulated in the subgroup? This is just the multiple layer of jurisdiction document that we've been working on, so I took the most recent state of it, cleaned it up a little bit, and have provided it here. This is our working document, so it's accessible to all people at all times unless you have a Google Docs access issues, in which case we'll send around PDFs from time to time. The next layer, and one which is of particular interest, is the jurisdiction for the law used in interpretation of contract, what we're referring to as choice of law or governing law, the law that, in fact, is chosen by the parties. Here we are, this is where we need to dig deeper since the focus of our group per Annex 12 is looking at the effects of ICANN's jurisdictions for use in disputes on ICANN's operations and policies. As I say, a document in progress. Some parts of it are more settled than others. We are also working on, let me just go through the last bit here. There's also the jurisdiction for the physical location of disputes, which we're trying to call venue, which also brings in the type of forum, whether it's a litigation or an arbitration or an IRP. And in some cases, the actual provider is specified, such as the ICC or the ICANN IRP panel. Then one layer which is listed in Annex 12, but which we really haven't had any comment on yet, is relationship with national jurisdictions for particular domestic issues. There may be comments on this in one of our other documents, but we need to bring it in here. And last, one listed in Annex 12 is meeting NTIA requirements. And it's been suggested that now that the transition has been consummated and the NTIA contract has expired, NTIA approval requirements is not a factor and that this layer should be deleted. We'll need to look further into that question of whether this is still a relevant layer for our work. The other piece of work that we are working on at this point is trying to answer a question that's really posed in Annex 12, which is, what is the influence of ICANN's existing jurisdictions relating to resolution of disputes, i.e. the governing law and the venue, on the actual operation of ICANN's policies and accountability mechanisms? here we have another Google Doc that we are working on, and it is far from settled and really in so much of a working document that showing it to the group at this point would be premature. Of course, the document that's in front of you is also a working document and not a consensus document, although by and large the text that's in black doesn't seem to be causing controversy, at least not at the moment. So the point of our exercise is to try that I just mentioned to you of answering this particular question is to look at something which is where we're not talking about whether this is in scope or out of scope, but really about the substance of the question of what are the effects that ICANN's jurisdiction has on resolving disputes and then on how ICANN's policies operate and how the accountability mechanisms operate. And the question influence, which is taken from INX 12, is important because it is not a positive or a negative term. There can be positive or negative influences, so we will be exploring both. And to the extent that we find that there are influences and or really concerns that are raised that need to be fixed or can be considered possible candidates for fixing, it relates back to the so-called gap analysis. We'll then need to consider how we can remediate that or what the cost-benefit analysis is of remediating it. Ultimately, that will be also part of our recommendations to the extent that we find any issues that appear to require fixing, so to speak. So that is pretty much where we're at. Just to mention briefly that the two items we put aside, first was the question of whether it was in our scope to recommend moving ICANN's headquarters or place of jurisdiction from California and the United States. What we agreed to do was to put that aside and see if we had a problem that required fixing and look at potential fixes and see if there are any problems where the only viable fix would be moving ICANN. So we will revisit it in the context of a particular issue rather than discuss it as an abstract point. And last, the gap analysis that is mentioned in NX 12 has so far been somewhat elusive because there's very little discussion actually in Workstream 1 of a gap analysis occurring. And so we need to come back, again, probably in a specific context to see what gap analysis there is and what the results of it may have been and what it could be. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Greg, for this brief update. And we have 5 minutes before the top of the hour. I know that Caboose hand is up. I guess that it's worth noting that this is an update report and this work in progress and that nothing has been agreed. And as Caboose is stating on the chat, it's a good start for the group. And I see that many are in agreement with Caboose, especially from the governmental sector. So, Caboose, would you like to add anything to this very briefly?
Yes, I want to add something very quickly. The main problem we have is applicable law, and we have to start on that as soon as possible. This multiple layer, we have some result, but applicable law, as soon as we open our mouth, they will say that, no, this is not fallacy, this is implementation, and we never reach any point to start at what is applicable law to what case. We should have several cases, and we should discuss what are the applicable law under those cases. Thank you.
Perfect, Carlos. Thank you very much. So I don't want to expand on this discussion. I think this is going to be something that we will be discussing in Hyderabad, and therefore I would kindly encourage everyone to follow the discussion on the list and, of course, in our Facebook meeting. And with this, I would like to turn back to my co-chair, Mathieu, for our next agenda item.
Thank you very much, Ian. We actually have three remaining items in 3 minutes, so I think part of the conversation will certainly have to move on to the list, but it's important. First one is the agenda and plan for Hyderabad. So what you're seeing on your screens, can we move one step up, please, is our draft agenda. We are trying to shape an agenda with time slots that match, the discussions that we've had right now during this session were really a preview of what we need to expand on during the Hyderabad face-to-face. So we'll have basically four sessions with as little administration as possible, which still needs some. We'll have an introduction to the dashboard that staff has been preparing in order to raise the transparency of the reporting from our group to a new level. And actually, we're pretty proud of what the staff and has been designing for this. You need to be aware that rapporteurs are being asked to provide some input in terms of updates that can be incorporated into this, and that by the time we are in Hyderabad, we are hoping to get some financial reporting as well as obviously these updates and a draft mock-up type prototype dashboard is going to be shared on the list shortly after this meeting, because we won't have time to discuss this at length. But we'll have time in Hyderabad to discuss so that the full community can be updated on our work. So we'll have IRP, we'll have the various groups with time slots that really we've tried to match to the amount of discussion we're anticipating. Can we go to the next slide? There's two things that might change from the slide that you're seeing. One is obviously the exact timing of the exchange with the ICANN CEO. It's not confirmed yet. The second is that we need to have a discussion on ATRT3 following the recent letter from Steve Crocker. We'll have to find a way to spot it somewhere. And I noted from Sebastian that he's announced a significant discussion on the Ombudsman, which might need to be placed somewhere. We'll discuss this with the various rapporteurs. So that's how we're seeing the agenda right now. We'll share this draft on the list so that everyone can chime in. Our goal is to provide clear slots so that people can join into the conversation at the specific hours. And you've seen today that we'll have more than enough for very substantial discussions and hopefully to be able to report at the end of the day of significant progress and calls for input from the community. That's it for the face-to-face meeting, and I'm moving straight on to AOB after that. Are there any other business to be raised? Chris, your question about workstream two subgroup reports. No, there are some reports and discussions in the morning and others in the afternoon. That depends on the topic. So we'll share that in detail on the list so everyone can chime in with their respective requests, please. I hope we'll have most of the group available for the full day. That's why we are getting there and getting significant support from ICANN. But obviously, if there are any specific issues, we need to anticipate on that. Good. So with that, yes, Chiro, we will need to look at the proposed dashboard on the list and in Hyderabad as well. So I think we're good for this call. Thank you so much for the very interesting and useful discussions. We're set up for a good meeting in Hyderabad. Safe travels to all of you who are going there. I will be participating remotely, but certainly following very carefully what Thomas and Leon are doing on site. So thank you so much, and have a good day, night, morning, whatever is your time for you right now. Cheers, and talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone. Bye.